Paul Ainsley. I tell you, Mr. Gamut, Mr. Schaff, they sure didn't make a mess in here last week with all those fireworks.
Yeah, Sierra, at least they didn't light the studio on fire this time.
Today is July 10th, 2013, and this is episode number 212 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamut, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, expert on living vicariously. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com. It's kind of like, it's like the backwards.
It's something like that. I really enjoy living vicariously through you, Brian.
No, it's the other way around. I live vicariously through you.
Well, this is awkward.
No, but in the meanwhile, Ainsley and Sierra did a pretty good job of cleaning this place up after our mishap last week.
You know, they're really good. I mean, they've taken care of walls that have blown out. I'm still kind of surprised that they were able to get down the award stand that you built.
Yeah, I know. Right. Yeah, they're pretty good. Hold on a second,
Sierra. How many times have I told you I want Irish cream syrup in my lattes? If you keep this up, you're going to find yourself back on the streets.
Yes, sir.
God. I shouldn't laugh because it really bothers me that he gets your drink wrong.
I know. It's like he doesn't appreciate working for free or something.
I know. Ainsley, I think he's a much better intern because he has never, ever put ice in my podcasting juice.
That is probably for the best. I wouldn't want to see you when you're angry.
No.
All right.
No, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
All right. Well, our millennial interns aside, we've got a couple of good topics this week.
We do. Where do you want to start?
I don't know. Do I need to get the dice out?
Yes, because we haven't used dice in a long time, and it's completely inappropriate to use right now, so yes.
All right, so the an odd number will be the one that has an odd number.
Okay.
Well, it's 11, so we're talking about iOS 7 and the betas that have come out so far.
Ah, excellent. Okay. And 7 and 11 are both prime numbers, so...
They are, and they're both, of course, involved in a certain fast food or the convenience store chain.
That's true. I'm betting the numerology aspect, Ainsley and Sierra could both fill us in on what that means.
That is probably true.
But since we've already kicked them out of the studio...
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've been able to see a lot about iOS 7 through... videos and articles that have been cropping up all over the internet.
Right. So why don't we actually start then with the fact that there's an NDA tied to these betas. So the betas are available only to developers, and there's an NDA associated with them. And you might hear the outrage on my voice out there and think that I'm like upset about people breaking the NDAs. No. I'm upset that there's an NDA. It's so pointless.
It really is. I mean, Apple showed us several features during Worldwide Developers Conference. So those really can't be covered by an NDA.
Right.
And
well, yeah. That stuff can't. And of course, they put stuff up on their website. Apple itself put stuff up on the iOS 7 preview site. I'm not wanting the beta to be available to everyone. I'm wanting for there not to be a pointless NDA that prevents people like you and I. You know, if we're gonna install iOS 7 on a device and talk about it, we're breaking someone else's NDA, or we have to sign up for developer accounts ourselves and break our own NDAs.
Right, and there's so much information that's out there already that Apple is not forcing people to take down. that the NDA seems like this hollow thing. And really, the only people it's stopping from just widely sharing what they know are
it's the people that play by the rules.
Yeah, it's us, the honest people.
Yeah, really, really, really frustrating. So what I think that Apple should do is that Apple should accept reality, and I think that Apple is, and that they're not sending.
They're not doing takedown notices.
They're not doing takedown notices, and they don't appear to be. I haven't heard anybody complaining about having their account shut down, except for the people that are selling access to iOS 7. Now that's just wrong.
Yeah, that's uncool. That's bad for everyone, and yeah. Ultimately they could end up screwing all developers.
Yeah, exactly. But what I do think they should do is allow journalists to access the same developer downloads and be able to talk about them. And to allow the developers to talk about it officially.
That I would like that a lot, actually. That would be really cool.
Yeah. That's what
and
they should
it
do.
Makes sense. And I think that would be good for everyone, because then developers could more easily discuss what's going on and what impact the new iOS version will have on them. And then they can work in conjunction with bloggers and media, and get information in front of the soon to be end users of the product, so people are up to speed on what to expect.
Well, yeah, I'm a little bit less worried about the idea that it's our job to bring people up to speed. It's just I know that people want to hear about it.
Well, okay, so...
And developers need to be able to talk about it. Developers need to be able to freely exchange ideas and information so that they can learn from each other about how best to take advantage of the especially with this switch from iOS 6 to iOS 7, because it's such a big deal.
I agree. And so what I really mean by up to speed isn't that we need to put together how-to manuals on using iOS 7, but that through the observations we have, the discussions that we're having and that developers are having, end users are ready to go or are better prepared just simply by being exposed to more information mm-hmm. when the OS comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I agree. And yeah, and all this is reflected in the fact that there is tons of information. There are untold thousands of videos on YouTube. Untold thousands. There have been some fantastic articles by really, really smart developers talking about some of the changes and really smart observations. Some of the usual suspects out in the Mac web have published detail. You know, whenever there's a new seed, they're publishing screenshots and you know, detailed information. We've been putting up some information too, based on what's being released out there. But you know, it's just this sort of pretense that there's an NDA doesn't really serve anyone, and it doesn't serve Apple. And I'm also not wanting iOS 7. Or any new operating system from Apple to be fully dissected and criticized when it's in a beta stage, but that's what's happening anyway.
That's true. And I mean, there are people that have, through whatever method, gotten a hold of iOS 7, installed it on their only device, and then immediately started complaining because of things that don't work, stuff that's breaking for them, it's crashing, and that's why I wrote that whole editorial about it's beta.
Yeah, it's beta. It is beta. Yeah, that's true. If you're going to put this operating system on a device, you need to live with the consequences, and you need to not complain about the consequences. You can complain about the features. You can complain about the way stuff is looking. But even there's some things that you need to accept that aren't done yet. That just aren't there yet.
That's right. And that's how beta software works.
And that's really the nature of Apple's NDA. But it ignores the practical reality that people are doing it anyway. This operating, if Apple is going to allow its entire developer community to download the OS at this early of a stage, the secrets are going to get out there. There are no secrets. There are just too many people. And keep in mind, all of Apple's competitors can have developer accounts too. You know, Apple's not vetting these developer accounts.
That's true. Yeah,
you pay your $99, you get your account.
Do you remember long ago when the NDA was written so strictly that developers couldn't talk to each other
yes.
about the fact that they had the software?
Yes.
I mean, how ridiculous was that?
Yeah, it is ridiculous, both from a practical and from a theoretical and practical effect.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. Apple really needs to rethink the way they're handling this whole NDA thing with their operating systems.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. All right. So now that said, let's talk about what all the people have put out there that have broken their NDAs.
Oh, how about if we start with fonts? Because that really got people's panties in a bunch.
Yeah, it did. And can I kick off with the fact that I liked the Helvetica new light. I like that sort of Art Deco look.
I really like Helvetica new Yay.
And is it new Yay? Sorry about that.
That's all right. What I did there was I very subtly corrected you so no one will know.
Well, that's good. That's good. I wouldn't want anybody to know what an idiot I am. But so what we're talking about is the font that was first shown at WWDC and was part of iOS 7 beta 2 or seed. Really, it's called seed 1 and seed 2. No, they're not betas, they're seeds.
Right. It's a really nice font and it looks really good. The problem that I had with it was that in some of the videos and screenshots that I've seen, it was too thin to be easily legible.
Yeah, I didn't. I get why people say that. I totally get why people say that. I just don't agree with it. I thought it was very legible, and it was just so gorgeous. Of course, you know, Yahoo's weather app
mm-hmm.
was clearly predicated on what was coming in iOS 7. The chances that they didn't have early access to iOS 7, to me, are none. Because this app is precisely an iOS 7 app. It's the same sort of multi-layer through transparency effect.
Right. Yeah, it has a very iOS 7 feel.
You know, I'm sure that Apple worked with Yahoo in producing that and releasing it ahead of time. But anyway, that said, I liked it there. Because there was it. Well, actually, you're the font expert. Was the Yahoo weather app Helvetica and UA light?
I don't remember. It's been actually a little while since I played with the app. If it wasn't, it was something very, very similar. And And I agree. It sure feels like Yahoo's weather app is inspired by iOS 7 design.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So that said, I'm glad that they switched from light to regular for the for
seed 3.
Thank you for seed 3.
Yeah,
for apparently seed 3. I can't count above 2 today.
So what Apple did is so basically it looks like it's a heavier weight.
Yes.
But it's a slightly different font also, right?
No.
It's not just a weight issue.
No, I think it's still Helvetica Nuit.
But Nuit Light to Nuit Regular?
Mm-hmm.
Are there not other changes in that? You like to say explain to us the difference because you are the font expert.
So, okay. Excuse me. So the difference from what I've seen from the shots that we've had access to is that they simply changed the weight of the font. So it went from being thinner overall for all the strokes, that the lines that make up each character, to just a little bit thicker. So that's really it right there. It's just a little bit thicker. And what that does, I think, is improves the legibility of all the type on iOS 7. And where I see that as really important is if you're someone that doesn't have really good eyesight, this will make it much easier to see. Now, what Apple could have done is said, here's our standard font here, and here are the options for people that have different levels of vision issues, and that they could have addressed it that way. And then for everyone that wanted to have what the default would have been, which would have been the light version of Helvetica Neue, they could have had that, and other people could have made it fatter.
Right. That's true. But, you know, Apple rightfully... That's the sort of fine control that Apple tends to not make its users decide about.
That's true. And giving users that option, while it would be nice, it changes the overall Apple branding, I think, because when someone picks up an iOS device or someone is using one and you happen to be able to see the screen, mm-hmm. Apple wants it to be very clear you're using an iPad or an iPhone.
Yeah, they're very protective of that overall experience.
So
the reality, though, is we're still only at seed 3. This is still so early in the process. This OS is not going to be released until the end of September at the earliest.
My guess is end of September.
I believe it'll be end of September. I think they're going to want to get those next round of iPhone sales in on this quarter is what I think they're going to want to do. But that said, iOS 7 is not going to be released until the end of September at the earliest, and we are still early in the process. You know, this is what, the second week of July. So, you know, we've got several versions of this to go. What they're doing right now may still not be final when it comes to this font. Next week, they tend to do these seeds in 2 week batches. The mm-hmm. the next one, seed 4, could well be Helvetica Neue Bold, or it could be Comic Sans. It won't be Comic Sans, but I mean the point is that we're still not final.
I can't believe you even said that as a joke. What is wrong with you?
You know Dave loves Comic Sans, don't you? Did you know that about Dave?
I'm
talking about Dave Hamilton, my co-publisher here at the Mac Observer, and the co-host of the Mac Geek Gab.
And you're serious, right?
Oh, he loves Comic Sans.
He really loves Comic Sans.
Or at least he did at least. I don't know that I've talked to him about it in the last 10 years. Because I've wanted to kind of pretend that it wasn't the case. But
you know, if it turns out that Dave still loves Comic Sans, we're staging an intervention. I'm like really kind of upset right now.
I know. I'm kind of delighted to push your buttons.
Man. See, this is wrong on so many levels. First, Dave likes Comic Sans. Uh-huh. And second, the joy that you're getting out of realizing how upset this makes me. What the hell, man?
I'm kidding, I'm sure.
Oh my God.
Anyway, the point is that Apple, we're still at C3. What we're seeing now is not going to be, I mean, it's nowhere close to final. There's no aspect of this operating system that's final, and many pieces still aren't even there. Like, we still don't have a new version of iBooks, for instance.
Oh, that's true.
You know, and iTunes Radio doesn't seem to be complete.
Yep. And of course, there are stability issues. There are operating system components that simply aren't there yet.
Of course. But, you know, everything I'm seeing, I love the way Messages looks. I love the way Messages looks. Have you looked at any of those screenshots?
Yeah. And I do like how it looks. And the screenshots of mail that I've seen, at first I was like, oh man, could they have made this any less appealing? Mm. And the answer is yes, I could have used Comic Sans, but the look has kind of grown on me. Mm. and I think that the clean lines will actually work really well for mail.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm still not a fan of some of the icons, especially some of the icons with gradients in them.
One of the problems I'm having with the icons is that we're having some consistency issues. And specifically, I mean, if you look at the icons for like Safari and photo booth and notes,
right,
and
right.
Stuff like
Dave
that.
Dave wrote about that first week.
Yeah. And then look at the Game Center icon. Mm-hmm.
I like the Game Center icon, though. It doesn't have anything to do with games, but it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty icon, but it doesn't match anything else Apple is doing with icons.
Yeah, it does. It matches the photo icon. It matches...
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it does. No, it doesn't. Absolutely, it does.
Okay, go back and look at the screenshots. And if you look at photos, it definitely has several colors, much like Game Center does, on a white background. But Game Center is the OS 10.2 bubble glossy look. And nothing else has that 3D bubble glossy look. Everything else is just flat.
Yeah. I totally understand what you're saying. When I look at the icons, that one fits in a lot better than, you know, the App Store that's got the gradient behind it?
I think all of Apple's store icons, if you will, have gradients. So that would be App Store and iTunes Store. And I think the music icon has a gradient as well. Actually, I think if you look, I just brought up a screenshot. If you look, there are gradients in almost all the icons. So it's messages, camera, photo booth, iTunes, App Store, music.
Yeah, you're right.
Mail.
Yeah,
FaceTime.
Photo doesn't. Game Center doesn't.
Yeah, photos, Game Center, maps, contacts, notes, reminders, newsstand.
Don't.
Clock. Calendar. Okay, so it's like half of them have gradients and half of them don't.
Yeah, and I don't like the gradients. The gradients are cheap looking to me. That's the one thing. That's the only thing about iOS 7 that I haven't been in love with is really.
I'm going to make it bother you even more now.
Yeah, I think I deserve it after the Comic Sans incident, the great Comic Sans incident of 2013.
Yeah. Anyhow, look at the iTunes Store and the App Store icons, and then look at the mail icon. The light to dark gradient.
It's backwards. That's so sloppy.
And now you will never be able to unsee it.
Well, unless they fix it.
Well, until they fix it.
Until they fix it. Yeah, I don't like the Safari icon either. But I can live with that one. And I tell you, all the other changes are so worth it. If I have to have a few icons that are less than perfect, I'll take it. But I'm really hoping that those get fixed by the time it gets released. I mean, look at the Passbook icon. That's a solid icon. It's a solid change. The Game Center icon, the fact that it's a little bit different, I will accept that. But I still think it's a gorgeous icon. The Notes icon is attractive. Reminders is not necessarily attractive, but it's certainly effective.
Right.
The camera icon is fine. The photos icon, I think, is really attractive. I like the simplicity of the calendar icon. Some of these icons are fantastic. And the other ones are just...
I'm really partial to the contacts icon.
The what? The contacts icon?
Yeah.
I'm looking for
it. Like, if you look... On a non-phone. So look on the iPad. Mm-hmm. Look for screenshots of that. and you'll see the contacts icon. I really like that one.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah. That is actually, that is really attractive too. That is really attractive too. And, but like I said, we're still early in this. So, you know, there's still some things that are going to come and you know, if this is the biggest thing that we can complain about, and I know that some people don't like other aspects too, but for you and me, if this is the biggest thing that we can complain about, you know, we're living in a pretty good world.
Yeah, I have to agree. Okay, so here's a couple other things that I really like. And now I can't remember if they were things that they showed off during the keynote or if they're videos that I've seen online. Being able to do a swipe down on any of the app screens, mm-hmm. so from the Springboard, mm-hmm. and it takes you to the search. Mm-hmm. I just love that.
Yes.
And I really like that when you go to do the swipe to unlock, it just needs to be somewhere on the screen. It doesn't necessarily have to be in a little slidey bar at the bottom.
Right. Right. I think now, that, yeah, now that the, they've trained yeah. the world, the entire world understands swipe to unlock. Right.
Right. So they take away the little bar. Now you can just put your finger on the screen and swipe.
Yeah. Although that ridiculous lock screen image that I use on my iPhone, that will no longer have any relevance.
Well, just swipe right there and you can pretend like it has relevance.
It's true. It's true. So, yeah. And then I like the parallax screen effects with the moving background.
You have to have an iPhone 5 for that, as I recall.
Yeah, and the iPads work too. But I've seen some good-looking videos where I think that's very effective. Now, I still wish that Apple would give up a little bit of control over the lock screen and the home screen. But we do have some more information coming to that.
That's true. And I do like that we get more info. In I'll call it in notifications. Mm-hmm. That's really nice, and I would like to see the ability to add even more there, and make that customizable. And I realize that by saying that, I'm showing just how many times I will beat my head against the wall
right.
for Apple to give me more control than they want.
Right, right, and you know. Unlike a lot of people who bitch about this, we understand that you can't have your cake and eat it too. We like the fact that iOS works, and we like the tight control and we like the tight integration of apps, the uniformity of experience, and there are trade offs with that. And you know, for those folks who don't want those trade-offs, for those folks who want to want access to their file system, who want to be able to change keyboards, you know, at the drop of a hat. I mean, that's fine. Android is out there for you.
Yeah,
yeah,
and yeah, it's and that's okay.
Exactly.
It's I'm totally cool with the fact that there are multiple viable options out there for mobile device operating systems. Right. I think that's good for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just so happens iOS is the best choice for me.
Correct. Correct. And iOS 7 is looking better and better. It's just I was floored at the WWDC keynote, and I have continued to be impressed with what I'm seeing coming out of it since then with these seeds, and especially considering how early we are in the process, and especially how late in the process Jonathan Ive took over the design element, and Craig Federighi, for that matter, taking over the software element. Right, you know, we had two major changes in the way iOS was being managed, rolled out. Relatively, what would normally be late in the cycle, which was last November, when Scott Forstall was fired.
Right, and it's a testament to how hard and Apple has worked and how dedicated their engineers have been, because they were able to show a functional version of OS X and iOS 7. At developers conference,
yeah, exactly, and And we've seen so this is the third seed. We've seen they're releasing them every 2 weeks. They've made phenomenal progress, and I saw some reports of performance being greatly improved in this last seed, and it just seems like they're just making really fast progress. It's exciting. It's exciting.
It is exciting.
Good looking OS.
What's most exciting about this for me is that it feels like Apple has gone away from the let's put flashy features in just to wow people to what can we do to make this more efficient and far more functional for our users.
Yes.
And that's really exciting right there. Mm-hmm.
And no stitching.
Yeah, and none of the apps fall off the screen, even without stitching.
Even without the stitching, yeah. Alrighty, so there you have it. That's iOS, and this is we're pretty much halfway in the point where we would normally consider the fact that we've gone long. So let's move on to the Apple publishing antitrust case, which the verdict was handed down today.
Right, and so that would be our even topic for people that were keeping track of the dice rolls.
Yes.
So what happened was Judge Denise Coate handed down her ruling today in the Department of Justice antitrust case against Apple for ebook price fixing, and she ruled that Apple did in fact violate antitrust and had colluded with publishers to control the ebook pricing. And based on the way the DOJ presented its case, the way Apple presented its case, I was quite surprised. I did not expect at all the ruling to go the way it did.
I did not either. I did not either. For so many reasons, there's logic and practical, and there is law. Of course, you and I, aside from that that brief run of two lawyers I'm just messing up my joke because I didn't even think of it ahead of time. So you and I were in a short production of two lawyers on a weekend trip to Gay Paris. Do you remember that? Anyway, aside from that brief run, we haven't even played lawyers on stage or screen.
The lighting in that show is fantastic.
It was, but for some reason, people didn't keep buying tickets and they shut us down. But we're not lawyers; we understand that. But doing, just following this case as closely as we did, the DOJ's case seemed awful. It seemed full of holes. It seemed selective. It seemed like they were cherry picking data that took no effort to put in context and make it look completely different. And their arguments didn't even make sense. And then Apple's attorney, Oren Snyder, came in. His defense of Apple just seems so strong.
It really did. And for everything that the DOJ presented, Apple was able to say, actually, no, here's how it is. And they were able to offer very plausible reasons for everything that they were doing.
Yeah, and then the Barnes & Noble was looking for essentially the same deal. The timing, I think, is there's a little bit of a toss-up on what the timing is. I don't think that was proven in court that Barnes & Noble approached the publishers with the same deal that Apple wanted before Apple did, but it was certainly at about the same time. There's the fact that Amazon asked for the same terms that Apple was asking for once a shift was in the air. I mean, it's hard to understand. And let us make this clear. We respect Judge Denise Coate. This woman has been doing this for a long time. She's heard a lot of publishing-related cases. She did not just fall off a turnip truck. She is a solid jurist.
And she is the same judge that was dealing with the publishers before they chose to strike deals instead of go to court over all of this.
Yeah, and she also decided in Apple's favor. God, what was that case? It was like just a couple of weeks before this went to trial.
I don't remember.
Was it a trademark case?
It may have been, because I was thinking patent, but as soon as you said trademark, that sounds really familiar.
Yeah, we can't.
She has a history with Apple.
Yeah, and clearly doesn't have seemingly doesn't have a bias against Apple, and that she ruled in Apple's favor in this unrelated case. We do not doubt. We talked about this before the show. We do not doubt that Judge Coate had her reasons for issuing the verdict that she did.
Yeah, this would not be a frivolous ruling. She certainly thought through and weighed the evidence.
Yeah,
yet still came to this conclusion, which is where I'm having the disconnect, because I don't get how she got there.
Yeah, I don't either.
And her ruling was what, 160 something pages long?
160.
Okay, so 160 pages, and that's what, 2 weeks after the case closed or the trial closed. Yep. And one of my first thoughts was, geez, if you're going to write a ruling that is that long, which means it has to be very detailed, how could she do that without having started writing her ruling before the case even started?
Right, which is, I mean, she's quite frankly free to do.
Sure.
I mean, she said when Apple and the DOJ asked for her thoughts before the trial, she was quite upfront that she believed that the DOJ was going to be able to show that Apple colluded.
Right. And some people look at that and go, well, this shows that she's biased and that she had a thing against Apple. And maybe she did. Maybe she didn't.
Yeah, I don't think she did, though.
But this – I don't think she did either. But that in and of itself does not show that she had a bias. What it shows is that she had looked at enough of the evidence for
the case. Yeah, the evidence
that she
had been shown through all the discovery process, through the process of the publisher settling, right? Mm-hmm. You know, looking at all of that evidence – she already had an opinion, and she freely expressed that. And quite frankly, she's free to do that. This was a bench trial. This was not a jury trial,
right? And what happened? That's totally a normal thing for both sides to ask for her opinion before everything gets started.
Yeah.
And in some cases, that will sway the decision to move forward.
Yeah, it's like in other words, encourage a settlement.
Exactly.
Right.
So in this case, Apple's like, no, we're not going to settle.
Right. So, but there was nothing wrong in her doing that. And it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not she has a bias. It simply showed where her opinions were ahead of time. And she probably did start writing some of this ruling ahead of time. Whatever. It doesn't matter. I mean, this is the way this stuff works.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with starting that ahead of time. Although I could see where in Apple's appeal – they may try and spin some of that to their favor. We'll see.
Yes, we will see. We don't know, but we will have to see. So let's actually look at some of the specifics. Now, Philip Elmer DeWitt, our friend of the show, as Stephen Colbert would say, actually is like every talk show host is.
As Brian Chaffin just said.
Brian Chaffin just said, right.
As Brian Comic Sans Chaffin just said.
Wow, that's uncalled for.
Yeah, I totally crossed the line
there.
Yeah,
that's just uncalled for, sir.
Yeah. And yet I did it anyhow, and I don't feel bad.
Yeah, that's great. So he took a look at the 160-page ruling, and he broke down. He said that the last 38 pages of the ruling are the part that really matter, and he broke down the different arguments. So what she did in her verdict, because it's not a ruling, it's a verdict, right?
Yeah, this is a verdict. Yeah.
So in her verdict, she addressed each of Apple's arguments. There's the Monsanto one, which was, we probably don't need to get into, really. It deals with antitrust law.
Right. And for those of you that are like, Monsanto, what's Monsanto have to do with this? It's case law.
Yeah, case law. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah. So Apple just used another case as an example as to why the judge should rule in their
right. favor. And she just basically said, you're misreading that. So, you know, whatever. I don't think that, that you and I commenting on that probably isn't going to please anyone. So let's just...
So let's talk about intent
let's
instead.
Talk about intent. So Apple had argued very clearly that it wasn't conspiring to raise prices. It was just trying to enter into a business with conditions that made sense.
That would be favorable. Yeah.
Yeah. And Judge Koh said quite clearly, and I'm quoting, Apple's entirely appropriate or even admirable motives, meaning Apple's goals, do not preclude, and I'm quoting again, do not preclude a finding that Apple also intentionally engaged with the publisher defendants in a scheme to raise ebook prices. What she's saying is, like, it doesn't matter why Apple did it. You can't break the law even if your aims are good. She's got a point.
Right. Yes. And if that doesn't quite make sense in your head yet, think about the old adage, the means do not justify the ends. Right. That's basically what she's
saying. And legally
speaking,
that is almost always the case.
Yeah.
Right. Apple had also argued that there was no raise in pricing. There was no increase in pricing because some books were being withheld from the ebook market entirely. So their price was effectively infinite. So therefore, there's no increase in prices. And I like what she wrote about that. She said, this creative argument fails for several reasons. And the biggest one is that there's only 37 books that were withheld.
Right. And yeah, so essentially what she's saying is that the number of books that were withheld is negligible, and this was not actually an issue. And nice try, Apple, for trying to make it sound
with
like
the pat. And she also argued there was no evidence that it was going to become widespread. I would argue that if something hadn't come along, and we're going to get to Amazon in a minute, but if something hadn't come along to change the power structure with Amazon's dumping, that more publishers would in fact have windowed. They would have had to, because Amazon was destroying the perceived value of bestsellers and new releases. So she's probably right that there was no evidence, but logically speaking, I don't see how you can not accept that that's absolutely where it was going.
It sure feels like that's where we were headed. If you follow the logic train on that one, that's the station it goes to.
Right. And like I said, we're going to get to Amazon here in a bit. She also looked at the evidence from Walter Isaacson's biography called Steve Jobs, where Steve says that you're going to sign an agency contract, or we're not going to give you books, blah blah blah. Philip Elmer DeWitt pointed out that this was not proven. This was not a fact that was proven at trial, which is an important issue. This is just an opinion.
Yeah, this is something that's going to come up in the appeal.
Yeah, absolutely, this is going to come up in the appeal. And I'm with Philip. I think that Judge Koh is just wrong to rely on that for anything. Now, it might have informed her opinion, and the fact that it did inform her opinion is a good thing that she included it in her verdict. But I think it's a mistake. And that's the thing. This woman is such a competent jurist that when my gut instinct is that she made a mistake, my second gut instinct is that I'm probably wrong.
And okay, so my gut instinct is she made a mistake. My second instinct is, what do we not know from this trial that made this an okay thing for her to include in her?
Right. All of our opinions are informed by detailed reading for weeks on every single piece that we could get our hands on this. So, you know, we are certainly more informed than your average bear, but we weren't there and we're not lawyers.
Right. Although we did play lawyers in that one. Actually, I'm more qualified than you because I've played a lawyer in a couple other shows.
That's actually a good point. So you are more qualified. And our show, the brief run of our show, it was two lawyers spend a weekend in Gay Paris. It's a great, great play.
It was fantastic. It was you were just brilliant. Thank you. In that
play. Right? The way I handled the baguette?
Oh, my God.
How that show got canceled?
I don't know either. Someone had it out for us. That's all I can figure.
So then there was the issue of...
Give me an ooh-la-la.
Ooh-la-la.
See?
Right? Right?
I mean, you say that, and all I hear is, Tony, Tony, Tony.
Per se liability. Do you happen to know what that actually means?
Okay.
You were a cop. So, you actually, all joking aside, you were a cop.
Okay, there is that. So there are certain cases or certain instances when what you do, regardless of motive or what the actual actions are, it is presumed they are wrong. And so in this case, we're talking about a presumed liability. That's what they mean by per se liability. And so in this case, her quote that we have is, while vertical restraints are subject to review under the rule of reason.
Because Apple had argued that it was a vertical player, not a horizontal player, by which we mean that the Apple's position in the ebook market was not pervasive across all facets of the ebook market, but rather was like this sort of like this, you know, this vertical column sticking out in the middle of the ebook market, and what they did affected only themselves.
Right. So continuing to quote from Judge Code, Apple directly participated in a horizontal price fixing conspiracy. As a result, its conduct is per se unlawful, meaning simply because Apple was involved in this on any level, they were acting in an illegal fashion.
Right. And Philip asked the question, if Apple is a vertical player, how can it directly participate in its horizontal conspiracy? He's got a very good point when it comes to the law, at least we think so. I think that this is going to end up playing a role in the appeals too.
I would assume so, because if we can read that and then Philip can read that and we come to the same conclusion about, well, wait, we can't have vertical and horizontal at the same time in this situation. So how do you reconcile that?
Right.
And if we're thinking that, you can bet that Apple's attorneys are thinking about it in a much more sophisticated way than we are.
Right. And of course, that sophisticated way may include understanding exactly why she said that. So, you know,
right.
Just being realistic. So that kind of brings us back to the last point, which involves Amazon and the fact that Amazon was the monopolist in this market. Amazon was the one who had 80 to 90%, 90% really, share in the ebook market, and Amazon was the one that was dumping product onto the market below cost in order to extend its share and perpetuate its monopoly. And yet the DOJ went after Apple and the publishers. And that's the part that I don't get. That's the part that has never sat well with me. You know, from the very beginning, I always assumed it's funny. It wasn't until the trial that I thought anything other than Apple had done exactly what the DOJ had said, but that the situation was such that if you stop it, you're only going to have a chilling effect. I mean, you're going to restore monopoly power to Amazon. And it wasn't until Apple actually laid out its case that I began to think that I had been wrong in that opinion, that Apple had not done what it is that the DOJ had said. And one way or another, there was a monopoly, and that monopoly was abusing its monopoly. Why did the DOJ go after Apple and the publishers?
This is a question that is bothering me a lot,
and I would love for someone to be able to give me an answer, because if you have a company that you know to have a monopoly, and you know that they're using that monopoly to control the price of products in that market, why would you go after the people that are trying to break that price control and get in and compete? And the only thing I can come up with, and I know this is not what the DOJ actually really intends, is that the government wants to endorse Amazon's position as the market controller for ebooks.
It's a de facto endorsement?
It is a de facto endorsement, but it is a per se endorsement, but it is not a flat out
statement
that they are endorsing.
It's not a stated endorsement, but it's weird. It is weird, and it's difficult when you look at the fact that after Apple beget the sea change, because at the very least they started it, right? You know that's beyond they did initiate what became a big change in mm-hmm. the way ebooks were being sold and arrangements between publishers and retailers. They changed some things there, and after that happened, the market became more competitive. There were more players. There were more sources to buy ebooks, and there was changes in the experience as well. Even Amazon's Kindle player got better. The Kindle Fire. Well, the Kindle Fire is a piece of junk, but Kindle Fire HD is less of a piece of junk, and the Kindle app on iPad went from being pretty miserable to being pretty good after Apple showed what could be done with iBooks. I mean, the Nook became viable. Of course, the Nook is gone now. Funny enough, right. Although the Nook platform is theoretically still viable. I don't know.
The Nook got playbooked. That's what just happened.
Yeah, it did. And it just doesn't make any sense. Now she made another point that she said, if Apple is suggesting that Amazon was engaging in illegal monopolistic practices, and that Apple's combination with the publisher defendants to deprive a monopolist of some of its market power is pro-competitive and healthy for our economy, it is wrong. Another company's alleged violation of antitrust law is not an excuse for engaging in your own violations of law. Which, you know, it's funny. I don't actually think that that's the case, that it's always the case. I think that when you're looking at I remember seeing some opinions, some friend of the court opinions ahead of time, arguing that antitrust law does not affect new entrants to a market when there's an existing monopoly.
Yeah, this is an area where I have a feeling we'll be seeing varying rulings over the next few years, because if you go strictly by the law, by the letter of the law, violating the law because you think that another company is already violating the law and you're going to fix them through your actions, no.
Yeah, you really can't do that.
You can't do that. But in practice, it becomes kind of a gray area. And so I think we're going to end up with some rulings that kind of bounce around a little bit over the next few years until a solid base of case law comes out of these types of cases, because really we're kind of in a new world with antitrust as it relates to the digital world and these mega companies like Apple and Amazon,
mm-hmm. and Facebook and Google.
Exactly.
And even to a substantially lesser extent, Samsung. Things are in flux. And I am – and Apple immediately issued a very aggressive defense and statement. They said that we did not break the law and we're gonna appeal this.
Yeah. And
I think they will.
I have a feeling that we will get a reversal in appeal.
I have a feeling we will too, but I also had a feeling that Apple was going to win. I had a feeling that Apple was going to, I thought that Apple showed that they didn't do what the DOJ had said. And I'm not, you know, not talking about the Monsanto defense. I didn't ever really understand any of that. I didn't even delve into it because I knew it was outside of my bailiwick or outside of my wheelhouse.
I didn't dive into the whole Monsanto thing because, quite frankly, I didn't feel like spending that much time reading through all the case law for that.
But, right. And you know, the windowing thing, I always knew that was a little bit of a reach. But I thought that Apple had showed even very clearly that it was not the ringmaster of any of this stuff, and that Apple didn't care what the publishers did with other retailers, as long as they had their MFN clause, which is a standard operating procedure kind of thing when it comes to business agreements.
Right. And for people that aren't exactly sure what Brian's talking about, it's a clause in your contract with the companies you're working with, your suppliers, that says that if your competitors drop their prices, you can drop your price to match theirs.
Right. And in this case, this was Apple got to match the lowest price out there and still got its 30%.
Exactly.
And it's called the Most Favored Nation clause because it's named after international trading agreements where it's kind of a misnomer. Oh, it's not even kind of a misnomer. It is a misnomer, but everyone gets it. Right. The most favored nation status means that a government agrees that another country can have the most favorable terms that any other country has with it. Right. So, anyway, that's what it's based off of. And I thought that Apple did a very good job of explaining that they proving even that they didn't care what the publishers did with the other retailers, as long as they got their MFN clause, as long as they were protected. Once they were protected, that they were done, and they didn't care. And I thought they did a great job of showing that. And I think maybe that's the biggest reason why Judge Coates' verdict surprises me so much. Now that I express it that way,
right? Yeah, it really feels like Apple just got penalized for participating in an industry standard practice.
Yeah.
That's not even a bad practice.
Yeah. So Judge Coates knows, of course, that if Apple loses a particular, I don't know. You know, it's really funny. The DOJ did not have its A team involved in this, and I think it wasn't even the lead attorney that delivered closing arguments, if I remember correctly, and so maybe the DOJ wouldn't have appealed this if they had lost. But they probably would have. She knew that Apple was going to appeal this. So she would have put together her, and she knows that Apple has very good attorneys. And so her verdict would be designed to be appeal proof.
Unless, and I'm throwing conspiracy theory out here and qualifying this with, I don't believe it, unless she intentionally issued a ruling that she knew would lead to an appeals court, so it becomes someone else's responsibility to give a final verdict. And someone is going to toss that out there really believing it. I'm tossing it out there saying, of course, it's always a possibility, but no, that is not what happened here at all.
Yeah. Yeah. She will have done that. She would have put together the best verdict she could based on her most strongly held convictions. And so we'll see what happens in the appeals process, but I think, yeah, you know, I'm not being an Apple fanboy here. I want Apple to win this. I think it's important that Apple wins this, and I think that it will win this in appeals.
I think so too. And a lot of cases like this are won in appeals. So there's a lot happening here to make me hopeful that Apple will win.
Yeah, and it's important for Apple to win too. By the way, don't. This is a lot more than just the publishing industry. Apple approached the publishing industry effectively with the same deal that it has with everybody. And Apple does not want to be hamstrung by an antitrust conviction. And, you know, even if they don't end up paying, this isn't about paying money, actually, because the DOJ wasn't even asking for money. The DOJ was asking for changes in behavior and limits on what Apple and the publishers could do. Now, it will be money if we will soon have a string of class action lawsuits that are launched against Apple and the publishers, based mostly against Apple, since the publishers don't have any money because, you know, Amazon's destroying the industry, but whatever. A string of class actions launched against Apple based on this conviction. Even there, it's not going to even put a dent in Apple's cash flow, let alone the cash that they already have. But Apple wants to win this so that this is not an anchor.
I agree.
So they will put everything they have into the appeals.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm hopeful. I have reason to believe, based on the case Apple presented and the fact that so many other similar type cases get actually decided in appeals court, that Apple will get a reversal.
Yeah. I hope so, at least. All right, so we've officially gone a little past our time.
Well, then I guess we should cut ourselves off because it's probably dinner time for someone.
Exactly. So take us out.
And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamut, both places. And go check out Fresh Brewed Tales, because I hang out at coffee shops and I see stupid things.
Fresh Brewed Tales. And you can follow my account on Twitter at TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y. On app.net, I'm Brian Chaffin, also with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. My personal blog is at geektales.com. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us. And that's all for this week.
And remember, friends don't let friends use Comic Sans. Stay subscribed, everyone.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.